And welcome to our second show of what I'm calling Linda Radio until I come up with a better name for it. Now, let's see. I've unmuted my mic. You should be able to hear me. And the last couple hours I've been working with some of the music, trying to find some interesting stuff and some exemplary stuff. We'll talk a little bit about that. We're going to talk a lot more about political correctness. The discussion that we had yesterday, and in between I found an interesting article on the Duke rape case by one of Lou Rockwell's writers. We'll talk about that in relation to it. But I think the first thing we want to do is, and let's see, I don't know how long we'll run today. Maybe an hour, maybe a little longer if we're feeling inspired at the end of that. And I wanted to say that I don't think you can get me at a Linder Skype right now, but you can get me at VNN Free Talk Live on Skype. You can also call into our number, which is 660-675. Oh, I'm drawing a blank here. It's the end part of it. Let me check it out here. I think it's 4388. No, it's 660-675-4388. You can call in to that from a landline if you want, and we'll pick it up and talk to you. But let's start, and one of the cool things here is I kind of learned my way around what we're doing, and someone can let me know if they can hear or not. I just added to the thread that we started yesterday in the VNN main forum under general discussion, sticky for the radio. If you have any problems or there's something that I need to know, let me know in there. You have a question, I'll try to get to that. In fact, let me go there right now and see what's going on with it. But I have a couple songs I want to play and make a couple points about them. That's what I'm going to do here after I check this out. Looks like everything's working pretty good. Let's see. Okay. Yeah. Second from the top in general discussion, if you want to say anything, but we're running right now. And first thing we're going to do is listen to this song. I think this is a song that I've mentioned before called The Kids by Eminem, and it's anti-drug and anti-anti-drug public officials, school teachers, etc. So let's listen right now.
Everyone should get along.
Okay, children, quiet down, quiet down. Children, I'd like to introduce our new substitute teacher for the day. His name is Mr. Shady. Children, quiet down, please. Brian, don't throw that.
Shut up.
Mr. Shady will be a new substitute while Mr. Kniff is out with pneumonia.
He's got AIDS.
Good luck, Mr. Shady.
Hi there, little boys and girls.
Fuck you.
Today we're gonna learn how to poison squirrels. But first, I'd like you to meet my friend Bob. Say hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Bob's 30 and still lives with his mom. He don't got a job. Bob sits at home and smokes pot. But his 12-year-old brother looks up to him an awful lot. And Bob likes to hang out at the local waffle spot and wait in the parking lot for waitresses off the clock. When it's late and the lot gets dark and fake like he walks the dog, drag him in the woods and go straight to the chopping block. And even if they escaped and they got the cops, the ladies would all be so afraid they would drop the charge. So one night, Mrs. Stacy went off the job when she felt someone grab her whole face and said, not the car. But Stacy knew it was Bob and said, knock it off. But Bob wouldn't knock it off because he's crazy and off his rocker. Crazy good as Slim Shady is off the locker. You couldn't even take him to Dre's to get Bob a doctor. He grabbed Stacy by the leg as he chopped it off her and dropped him off in the lake for the cops to punch. But ever since the day Stacy went off the wonder, they never found her, and Bob still hangs at the waffle diner. And that's the story of Bob and his marijuana and what it might do to you. So see if this world's going in his past.
See, children, drugs are bad. And if you don't believe me, ask your dad. And if you don't believe him, ask your mom. She'll tell you how she tells him all the time. So get saying help with drugs, so you don't act like everyone else does. And there's really nothing else to say. Drugs are just bad and hard.
My penis is the size of a peanut. Have you seen it? Fuck no, you ain't seen it. It's the size of a peanut. Speaking of peanuts, you know what else is bad for squirrels? Ecstasy is the worst drug in the world. If someone ever offers it to you, don't do it. Kids, 2 hits will probably drain all your spinal fluid. And spinal fluid is final. You won't get it back. So don't get attached. It'll attack every bone in your back. Meet Zach. He's 21 years old. After hanging out
drive and his eyes roll back in his skull. His back starts to look like the McDonald's arches. He's on Donald's carpet laying horizontal barfing. And everyone in the apartment starts laughing at him.
Hey, Adam, Zach is a jackass. Look at him.
They took it too, so they think it's funny. So they're laughing at basically nothing except maybe wasting their money. Meanwhile, Zach's in a coma. The action is over and his back and his shoulders hunched up like he's practicing yoga. And that's the story of Zach, the ecstasy maniac. So don't even beat at the squirrel's class.
Happens to children's drugs, boy.
Right.
And if you don't believe me, ask your dad.
Right.
And if you don't believe him, ask your mom. She'll tell you how she does them all the time. So kids say no to drugs. So you don't act like everyone else does. And there's really nothing else to say. Drugs are just bad
and curse. And last but not least, one of the most humongous problems among young people today is fungus that grows from cow manure. They pick it out, wipe it off, bag it up, and you put it right in your mouth and chew it. Yum, yum. Then you start to see some dumb stuff, and everything slows down when you eat some of them. And sometimes you see things that aren't there. Like fat women in G-strings but orange hair. Mr. Shady, what's a G-string? It's yarn, Claire. Women stick them up their behinds, go out and wear them. And if you swallow too much of the magic mushrooms, whoops, did I say magic mushrooms? I meant fungus, your tongue gets all swole up like a cow's tongue.
How come?
Cause it comes from a cow's dump. These drugs are bad, it's a common fact. But your mom and dad, well, that's all that I'm good at. But don't be me, cause if you grow up and you go in OD, you're gonna come for me. And I'ma have to grow a goatee and get a disguise and hide, cause it'll be my fault. So don't do drugs and do exactly as I don't, cause I'm bad for you.
See, children's drugs are bad. And if you don't believe me, ask your dad. And if you don't believe him, ask your mom. She'll tell you how she does them all the time. So kids, say no to drugs. So you don't act like everyone else does. And there's really nothing else to say. Drugs are just bad and good.
Come on, children. Clap along. Sing along, children.
How about that? I like that. That's Eminem, The Kids. And I'm going to be posting some show notes every time I do one of these, and there'll be a link to the lyrics. In fact, I happen to have those lyrics right in front of me, and I'm going to read a few of them, just because it's kind of funny. Let's see. No, I'm not. We're going to go in a different direction. Now here, I'm going to play another song. This song, and I didn't mean to make it about music today, but I was looking around, finding different things. And there's a couple things that I specifically wanted to talk about in relation to what kind of stuff gets put out there for public consumption. Here's a song that I don't believe was ever released as a single, so it wasn't on the chart, but it's, as you listen to this, if you haven't heard it, and many of you probably have, some of you probably haven't, it's called One in a Million by Guns N' Roses, and you'll see maybe why it wasn't released. Pay attention in the lyrics, and think about what kind of This is one of my hobby horses, and since it's my show, I'm going to ride the hobby horse. My hobby horse is leftist punk-ass bitches who can't handle the fact that corporations pursuing profit does not explain the mass media and what we get in them. Of course they pursue profits, but it's not their number one goal. Their number one goal is their political agenda, and this will tie into the political correctness. Lenin and the Jew communists that we're going to talk about later. And the Duke rape case. But right now, you listen to this and you tell me that this isn't better than most of what you hear out there. Why wouldn't it be released? Listen. One in a million Guns N' Roses.
You know we tried to reach you,
Once again, that was Guns N' Roses, One in a Million, which I think is a pretty good song.
Uh-oh.
Dreaded Toto's playing.
Stop, Toto. No. Wait. No.
All right. I'm trusting that that worked. Let me check here. There are certain things I'm still learning as I'm fiddling around here, trying to find out what happens. If you get a whole playlist set up and you don't, stop it, it will cycle right on through. So, we'll play a couple other tunes as we go on. Now, let's see. I have a long thing I plan to talk about in relation to political correctness. But I think we may have a caller first, and we'll talk for a while. Let me see here. I want to play one more while I'm sorting a couple of things out here. This is my personal favorite, and I may use this. This is my favorite Guns N' Roses song. And I think it relates to life in a lot of ways, although it's actually, if you haven't heard it, you can guess what it's about. But I really like it. Let's listen to it now.
We'll be right back.
That again was Mr. Brownstone by Guns and Roses. Now let's see. You know what? We're going to have a call at some point, but what we're going to do right now is just go ahead and dive right in. Why don't we dive right in by interpreting one of the easiest events in recent American history? Let's see here. Take it sacred. The farmer takes the earth. He holds it sacred. I feel that way about history. Let's go to the article I posted on VNN. And let me know if you can hear me. I did it with a couple of Skype controls, and I have a slightly different sound in my ear. This is something by William Anderson. He's one of the LouRockwell.com writers. He is a white man who's a professor at a minor university. I believe he has two black kids because, you know, color doesn't matter. I mean, we're all individuals here. Correct? And that, by way of background, explains some of his incredible, incurable blindness. But he's done a good job of following the Duke rape scandal and pointing the way to a couple people who really covered it full time and probably are as responsible as anyone for seeing that justice was done. But he has a story up there today. And the reason I want to talk about this is in relation to Frank Ellis's Marxism, Multiculturalism, and Free Speech to show you that the murderous, lying impulse behind communism is still there and in many ways stronger than ever. It doesn't quite have the power to murder Americans today, but it has the power to deprive them of liberty and livelihood, if not life, right now. But he talks about, take Sally Deutsch. Now, you've got to assume she's a Jew. I've never met any Deutsches who weren't Jews, like Donnie Deutsch on cable. Take Sally Deutsch, Duke's Dean of the Social Sciences of Trinity College, for example. Historian Ralph Luker recalls talking to her at a recent conference. She bristled noticeably when I said that, after all, he'd, blogger and historian Casey Johnson, he's one of the probably the main guy who covered the facts about the Duke case as it unfolded, turned out to be correct about the lacrosse case. You mean about the charges being dropped? She asked. I started to say, no, read my lips. There was no rape. But the hairs were already standing up from the back of her neck over to her eyebrows and her eyes were flashing. Deutsch had signed the infamous We're Listening advertisement of April 6, 2006, along with 87 of her colleagues. The series of statements which appeared in the Duke Chronicle praised the protesters who called for the white Duke lacrosse players to be, quote, castrated and given, quote, equal measures, and thanked the protesters for, quote, not waiting to find out the truth. After all, they already knew the truth, even if they didn't know it. So, all right, someone sent me a back-to-school clip. I'm going to play this right now. This will be an exciting little thing, and we'll see if, that's what I quoted just a little bit from. We'll see what this is. This will be an exciting little interruption in our discussion of political correctness. Meanwhile, we're waiting on a call. Let's see. Here we go. Let's see how this comes across. Let me know if you can hear this.
At least know where your next class is.
Contemporary American History, Professor Turgis.
One of the best.
Well, you know, is he good?
In the movies.
Well, he's really committed. In fact, I think he was. Just keep your head down, keep your mouth shut. You should be all right. Well, I'll see you in English.
All right.
Welcome to Contemporary American History. I'm Professor Turgeson. You know, a lot of people think history is just facts. It's just information about the past. But not me. I mean, I hold history very sacred. Sacred. The way the farmer looks at the earth and he holds it sacred. The way a Christian Bible holds it sacred. The way a lot of people hold their marriage sacred. So I feel about it. So why don't we dive right in by interpreting one of the easiest events in the last 20 years of American history. Now, can someone tell me why in 1975 we pulled our troops out of Vietnam?
The failure of Vietnamization to win popular support caused an ongoing erosion of confidence in the various American but illegal Saigon regimes.
Hey, Alex.
Is she right? Because I know that some people like to believe that.
I wish I could, but I was there. I wasn't here in the classroom, hoping I was right, thinking about it. I was up on my knees in rice paddies with guns and Edwards going up against Charlie, slugging it while pussies like you were back here partying, putting headbands on, doing drugs, listening to the goddamn Beatle albums.
Hey, Professor, take it easy, will you? I mean, these kids, they were in grade school at the time. And me...
Well, I didn't know you wanted to get involved with the discussion, Mr. Helper. But you remember that thing we had about 30 years ago called the Korean conflict? How come we didn't cross the 38th parallel? By trying it, I'm taking the Berkeley brick and New Deal back into the fucking Stone Age River! How come? Tell me why! Say it! Say it!
Because Truman was too much of a pussy wimp to let MacArthur go in there and blow out those commie bastards!
Good answer. Like the way you think. I'm gonna be watching you.
A good teacher. What, I have no idea.
All right, that was a clip from Back to School. Let's see if we got... Andre, you there?
Yep.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Very good.
And I've asked someone else to let me know if they can hear you as well, so we'll see. Now, you wanted to talk, I understand, about the meltdown in the subprime mortgage market.
Well, and it developed in someone, and, about how these things were completely predictable to 5 years ago, we knew this was going to be a meltdown. We knew the Iraq War was going to be a disaster. 40 years ago, we knew racial integration would be a disaster. They did it anyways, and it's been a disaster. The only difference is the Iraq War is more of a cover-it-up. It's a, it's millions of private tragedies rather than, a big spectacle like the World Trade Center or the grind of the Iraq War. He was saying, well, this proves incompetence. And a person I just talked to, a mutual mm-hmm. friend of ours, said, no, it's, they planned a lot. For example, Richard Pearl knew it was going to be a cakewalk. Paul Wolf knew the Iraq War was going to be a mess. And he said, absolutely, that's part of our whole plan. I wonder what you think. Is it incompetence, or is it an evil plan?
You mean housing, or you mean the Iraq War?
I mean, well, let's say, the Iraq War. When Richard Pearl said it was going to be a cakewalk, did he really believe what he was saying, or did he know it was going to be a disaster?
I don't know for sure. I find most persuasive the argument that what the Jews wanted was to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And anything after that was far, far down the list and very important. So they got rid of it and Iraq screwed up. At least them had to have an idea that it would be screwed up. I mean, if they did what they did here for racial integration, they definitely knew it wasn't going to make things better. So that would be that they knew they'd get rid of Saddam Hussein, they'd bomb the smithereens. They probably suspected that wouldn't play real well with the locals. But I think also some are insane enough that they probably did believe it. On the whole, I put it towards, we can fuck the country up, we can break it into parts, we can delay indefinitely it's becoming a nuclear or any kind of physical threat to Israel. Let's do it.
Okay, so you're saying evil. You're saying evil.
I think it probably leans that direction. I mean, some Jews are so fanatical that they actually believe their own bullshit. But it's hard to separate all things. I think they just like messing things up and dirtying for their own sake, so it appeals to them to bomb people and kill them. I mean, even before we were bombing, we had sanctions on them that were killing their people. So it's a mix of those different things. I mean, everything is flipped when it comes to the Jews. They call, 50th the Dark Ages, and we had virtually no federal taxation, and people lived in their own communities, and it was totally safe. That, to them, is the Dark Ages. So what the Jew thinks is good is something a cockroach would be happy in. Something dirty, filthy, with graffiti over it and broke glass. I mean, that to them is good. So who knows what... It's hard to interpret them in our terms. From our way of looking at it, look, we have no reason to fight with Iraq. They haven't done anything to us. We don't have to like them or deal with them at all, really. Just buy oil from them. But they don't look at it like Aryans. So, what about the housing, though? Where do you go to get information on the housing market? You there, Andre? Oh, he may have fallen out. Let's see. I'm going to play another song and see if I can... get him back on. This is one I played in the warm-up. It's called It's called I'm Happy Every Day I Live by, I think it's by Miss Mary Ann and the Something Wranglers. Listen to it.
I'm here.
All right, we had a bit of a problem there. Don't know what it was. We're back. Let's just go where we were. We were talking about housing and the subprime.
Well, is it incompetence or evil?
Again, I don't know.
I mean, because
I would always tend to wait it.
Yeah, what we call evil. You know, bad intentions. I mean, strangely, all right, my Soviet Union, the Jews, you know, started it, initiated with the Bolshevik Revolution. They were planning on putting Trotsky in. Trotsky, apparently, from what I've heard, was married to a Rothschild. And then Stalin pulled the rug out from under them and, you know, was going to do a purge of the Jews. Mm-hmm. That's why I say incompetence and, you know, blinded by arrogance. Also, look at the state of Israel. You know, they got their butts kicked by a year ago from today, and you know, it's only naive Gentiles that prop them up. You know, again and again. I mean, it's only their ability to tell lies. Competence. I mean, I see incompetence, and you know, in corporate America, you have to be willfully blind. You have to ignore all the, you know, all the obvious things that are really ugly and stupid and wrong, and just on you getting your paycheck. I mean, that's the way law works. It from where I can see it. Mm-hmm. And so I argue for, you know, what is termed as willfully blind. That's not my term, but, you know, I'm willfully blind. So I don't, you know, I'd like to. I mean, subprime meld, I totally predicted. We're talking about 5 years ago, now it's happening. I think you remember talking about it with me. I thought it was happening now. It was going to happen in 2004. That was 2 years
too
early.
It's pretty clear that they're pushing artificially created money. Yeah, onto people who are not credit worthy, and then I agree with you. I think it's so much dirtiness. Everyone is this kind of relates to political correctness I was talking about yesterday. It forces you to exceed these lies, and one sector of the lies you exceed is, oh, these people are Americans. Oh, they're people who are Mexicans who hate America become Americans, and people who aren't credit worthy suddenly are credit worthy, and everyone and everything. And it's the tendency of democracy to develop slobs and pretend there are no distinctions between people, but it's cast in a Jewish mold. I mean, it's the particular form takes is congenial to Jews. So. And then when you see reporting on the great battle, it'll, you know, you can't win, because if they weren't, they were speaking to only many people who are credit worthy, just call that redlining.
Yes.
And the minute they're damned, they do, damned, they don't. So the minute they go and say, okay, birth by law, because the Jews in the newspaper and the Jews in the bank regulation industry get together and force banks, force basically, you know, white-owned banks to make loans to coloreds, and then when they can't pay, you know, the economy goes south and the government picks up, and of course they just print more money because that's the only option they have. So whites get screwed all the way around. One person who works and saves money like you're supposed to get screwed all the way around. So
that's true. But ultimately, you sound to be arguing for incompetence, no? I mean, when
it's
all played out, it's going
to
be incompetence.
I mean, it's good for Jews bringing these people from the third world.
Right.
And it's also good for business. It's better to have dumber people, and people have low IQs, and they read faster, and they're not smart enough to threaten the income of the elite, and they add to the bottom line, because they can only market for stuff like loans and everything else. So it helps the people who own, for reasons. It's the white class people get screwed.
because they were up when these doctors and they had the negative actions of these around Mexicans, and it's just not in the interest of the white ass people. It's run for the interest of the elite, which are dominated by Jews at the agenda. They're not composed wholly of Jews. There's plenty of women who are in the 1980s, some in the mortgage industry, talking about today. There's always been done to do an issue the most money, and that is to collude with people, appraisers, that overvalue houses, and signs, like, oh, we know you're not like, well, you don't have any dumb, you know what, there's a way around that. So a couple more person is hired. And, you know, but that rate's locked in for 6 months, and then it floats after that, and now somebody's screwed. But, you know, it's a number of different motives coming together in a vile cocktail, and all you can really take away, and that means staying away from credit unless you're going to use credit to I'm going to say something that unless you're willing to steal the money that you're extending in credit, or you're going to pay off your balance every month, those are the only two things worth doing with credit. The rest, you're better off to buy stuff, whether that's gold or silver or something else. I'm not going to get into speculating about gold and silver like some of these other people do. I mean, it's lose all value the way paper usually does with fiat currency. That is currency printed on demand by the government, backed by nothing. You don't want to get stuck holding the bag, and the bag could be, you know, a bunch of green colored paper.
Yeah, well, you know, in general, I mean, we're already stuck holding the bag of this country, but it's avoiding, you know, the bad things is good, but you know, it's going to get us all anyway. I mean, when we're stuck in Brazil, they like the process, you know, the ruling, the Jews, the ruling elite, whatever you want to call them, they like the process of Brazilianization, but I don't think they're going to like the end result when they get Brazil, you know, the Brazil USA. I don't know. I'd like to, but the elites in Brazil who have to fly a helicopter over Rio de Janeiro, no wait, Sao Paulo, they got to fly a helicopter over today. You know, they have to fly helicopters over their capital city because they can't go on, they can't travel on the ground because it's such a hellhole.
Hey, yeah. Andre, I think we're going to have to break it off because they're telling me it's pretty much unlistenable right now. But I don't know. I mean, we were playing the music with no problem, and I was talking, I guess, with no problem. But
on the feed, it's not, you can't hear us, huh?
That's what I'm being told. I can't tell myself.
Okay.
But damn it. Anyway, well, thanks for calling in, and we'll have to get it ironed out and figure out what the deal is.
Yeah, I'll try another time.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for calling. Bye. Let's see here. What I'm going to do is try to establish that after the call with Andre Kievsky, we are back to normal in terms of people hearing what we're saying. And that will take about 90 seconds, and then I'll go into the political correctness I was going to talk about. Let's see. Okay. Dietrich, let me know if you would. Probably going to hear this in about 90 seconds. Right now, while I'm waiting for that, I'm going to play another little song. All right. Should I play that one? No. I'll play. What should I play? Here's a song you probably have not heard, but you might like it. It's called Gravity. Oh, it's not working. Let me try it again here. Hold on.
Everyone should get along. Okay, children, quiet down.
Okay. I'm going to try a couple other little things here and see if I can play something. Told it sounds back to normal, but I want to try a little something. Where is it? Let's see.
Then they came along in their giant truck, and they knocked you down. You should have seen yourself lying there all broken. Whoa, gravity, it got you good. that you were still out cold. And I thought of the time you said I was your favorite, that I'd love just like a holiday. Took me in, and then one day you put me on the highway. You said that gravity was gonna do me in.
Whoa.
I think we're back from that, and reports are that we talked to Andrea. I guess it was pretty much unlistenable, but we were talking about whether it was malice or incompetence that drove the meltdown in the subprime lending, as well as the war in Iraq. Is the war in Iraq a failure, or is it a public school failure that is an intentional result of the people who set up the system? And I argued it's probably more in that direction with a little bit of the other. We had some kind of bad connection. We'll work on that in the future. But for right now, we'll simply go ahead. And let's see here. Okay. Yeah, I'm just reading over a couple of comments on what might have been wrong with what we were doing. But tell you what, I'm going to play one more song, and then I'm going to get into, I'm going to get back to the political correctness article I was talking about. And I have some very good stuff. I want to get to the bottom of this. People keep writing about it, and they keep not saying what's most important. Let's see what we can do here. What's a good thing to listen to here? All right, let me look. Find. Could play a little of that. I'll leave that for later. I don't see anything I want to play, so I'm going right to it. Now let's see here. Now what I was talking about was, okay, we're going to go back to Chapter 3 of Marxist Multiculturalism and Free Speech. This is by Frank Ellis. Now, what we talked about yesterday was that they were saying that John Derbyshire at National Review, well, actually, in that case, he works for National Review, but he was writing for the American Conservative Magazine, said that political correctness was a question of manners, and it was very more of a recent thing. But in fact, he was conflating a number of different things that aren't related. And in fact, political correctness is not a recent thing, and it's nothing to do with manners. It has everything to do with ideological deviation from the Communist Party line. And to back up my point, I want to get to another part of we referred to Chapter 3 yesterday of Marxism, Multiculturalism, and Free Speech by Frank Ellis of Leeds University in Britain. This is the start, and I want to read this to you, and we'll think about it a little bit. Let me drag a light over here so I got a little more light. Oh. Let me see.
sure.
All right. Political correctness and the ideological struggle from Lenin and Mao to Marcuse and Foucault. Introduction. The suddenness with which political correctness entered the public domain in the period between 1989 and 1991 and the ensuing arguments about the legitimacy of Western culture, which lasted until well into the mid-1990s, implies that the concept of political correctness is a very recent phenomenon, the origins of which are to be found in certain intellectual trends of the late 20th century. Now, most of us will remember the origins of political correctness as Jeff Shesal, a Jew at Brown University, had a politically correct man as a character he created for a comic strip that he drew. Shesal, the Jew, later went on to become a Democratic operative in the Clinton era. But that was when political correctness really first came to national attention, and that's pretty much the only term that's ever been allowed to describe what is not a matter of manners, but is a matter of totalitarianism. Okay? Meant to make you exceed in lies by using this bogus language they've scripted for you to show that you go along with the program, A, or B, at least you're not going to fight it. So it's a symbol of, when you use PC terms, you're like a little dog lifting its leg in front of a larger dog. You're showing that you submit. Okay, I won't call them niggers. I'll call them African Americans. You understand that? It's a symbol of dominance and submission when you use the other guy's terminology. It can also be a sign of respect. If the guy comes up with a good term and you support it for honest, good moral reasons, that can be a good thing. But when it's someone you hate and you know that they're lying and you know that they're coming up with these terms to cover up reality and you go along with that, why, you become corrupted internally. And if this goes on hard enough and long enough, you get what a number of communist writers in Eastern Europe wrote about. I haven't even read all these books, but one Jeff Beck mentioned was, I think, The Captive Mind by Czeslaw Milos. No doubt I'm pronouncing that wrong, but this double-mindedness comes where what you say in public is completely different from what you think in private. And we're not talking as the Kerr Derbyshires of the world, the Jew appeasers who try to conflate manners and middle-class pretentiousness and hypocrisy with totalitarian control. We're not talking about that kind of thing where you're kind of nice and polite just because it helps liquidize human relations. We're talking about yielding to tyranny. Okay? Tyrants use language to prevent you from identifying and fighting what they're doing. And if you give into it, you become weakened and corrupted. It's harder to fight back. You essentially exceed in your own destruction when you use corrupt language. Very, very, very important to understand what's going on. And the Patriotard level people don't understand this. Okay, because they don't see anything below the label. But the higher level people, the ones who can think and see that there's something beneath the label, beneath the exterior, and they can actually generate internal criterion to understand things for what they are. If they exceed in those lies, they become demoralized. And that's no way for a man to live. So, what we're getting into here is with Alice's understanding the deep background, the roots of political correctness, which lie in the Jews' totalitarian drive to conquer the world, which proceeds along dual tracks, proceeds along the physical gun and bullet track, while at the same time proceeding along the lies, smears, labels, politically correct verbal reality track. So they attempt to foist a false world on you and to get you to exceed in it by browbeating or by bullets. Okay. Now,
congratulations.
Let me see. I don't know if you... That was a little pop-up ad that chirped up there. But what we got here is a failure to communicate for a while. I hope what I just said was clear enough, though. Now, what I'm going to do is... What I was trying to do before Kievsky's call was just give you a little modern equivalent so we can tie what's happened at Duke in the last year as probably the best or most representative example, and we tie that to the communist political correctness that began with Lenin back in the early part of last century. So, let's read what Anderson says, and then we'll compare it with what Ellis says. Anderson, again, is the, I think he's at a Frostburg State, which is in western Maryland. And, yeah, that's right, William Anderson, Ph.D., and some other technical problem here. What the hell? William Anderson teaches at economics at Frostburg State University in Maryland as an adjunct scholar of the Ludwig von Mises. And he's also a consultant. But what does he say? Okay. He says, when asked how we ever got to the point where facts don't matter, and, to further the point, the insistence upon emphasizing the facts of the case is in itself proof of guilt, the answer lies in the modern application of academic Marxism. For while Marx and his labor theory of value have long been discredited among economists, the Marxian narrative and the polylogism of which Ludwig von Mises writes in Human Action have become the pole star of higher education. One cannot understand what is happening in disciplines such as literature, English, history, sociology, and the gaggle of identity studies, such as African-American studies, women's studies, queer studies, and the like, that are dominating much of the academic curriculum, unless one understands the Marxist mindset, with its emphasis on narratives and power. So, again, they're trying to put over these false, what they call narratives, and just jam them over reality and make reality give way. And, you know, reality doesn't care. Reality keeps on being what it is, but the carriers of reality, which are you and me, are going to get crushed by this juggernaut if they can possibly drive it over us. He says further, this is Anderson talking, not Ellis. Anderson says, people who are skeptical about this particular direction which the academy, in which academe is headed, call it political correctness, and that is not far off the mark. Even though those on the academic left who first coined that term are now angry whenever someone throws it back at them. Well, they didn't coin it, as we know. He's again, like the Jew appeaser Derbyshire, pretending that this is a recent phenomenon when it's not. It's been going on for a long, long time. Indeed, if politics is about the usurpation of raw power by those in authority, then political correctness is an excellent term to describe what is happening, for modern academia is geared at increasing the power of the state. This is his libertarian ideology talking, to impose a way of life that all of what one might call natural law rejects. Well, yes, it is the state, but it's the Jews who control the state, and they're using it like they use everything to empower themselves and to prevent any or forestall any competition. Let's see. The belief is that the political process can be marshaled in a manner in which those in power can force people to do what they would never do otherwise, and even change the very face of nature itself. That's true. That's good stuff. While the hardcore political correctness has come to full fruition, if that is possible, in the past 15 years, the hard left has been dominant in higher education for nearly four decades. For example, when I was at the University of Tennessee in 1974, one of my religion classes was force-fed out-and-out communist Chinese propaganda, which touted the economic miracle that Mao supposedly had brought to that country. And he quotes other leftists, and the simple fact is that so many tens of millions of people were killed in the Soviet Union and in China that they're more or less uncounted, and they're untalked about. The left doesn't talk about them at all. It ignores the corpses and just pretends that they created wonderful new societies, and it carries on with the same mindset. But fighting a mindset is useless. The only thing you can do is fight the carriers of it. There will always be a percentage of people who are tempted to think that way, and that percentage will always be greater among the Jews, and the Jews will remain the driving power until the Jews are done in. You get rid of the Jews, you're going to be able to stop a lot of the rest of this, because the normal whites are going to be able to dominate the percentage of whites that that hate reality, because it's just not that high. This is interesting. He's quoting Rockwell, Lou Rockwell, about what happened in China. The communization of China took place in the usual three stages: purge, plan, and scapegoat. First, there was the purge to bring about communism. There were guerrillas to kill and land to nationalize. The churches had to be destroyed. The counter-revolutionaries had to be put down. The violence began in the country and later spread to the cities. All peasants were divided into four classes that were considered politically acceptable: poor, semi-poor, average, and rich. Everyone else was considered a landowner and targeted for elimination. So that's parallel to the elimination of the kulaks in Eastern Europe. If no landowners could be found, the rich were often included in this group. The demonized class was ferreted out in a countrywide series of bitterness meetings in which people turned in their neighbors for owning property and being politically disloyal. Those who were so deemed were immediately executed, along with those who sympathized with them. Interesting. Here's another thing that Rockwell talks about that Mao did. Mao, as the rivers of blood rose ever higher, Mao brought about the Hundred Flowers campaign in 2 months of 1957, the legacy of which is a phrase we often hear, let 100 flowers bloom. People were encouraged to speak freely and give their point of view, an opportunity that was very tempting for intellectuals. The liberalization was short-lived. In fact, it was a trick. All those who spoke out against what was happening to China were rounded up and imprisoned, perhaps between 400 and 700,000 people, including 10% of the educated classes. Others were branded as right-wingers and subjected to interrogation, re-education, kicked out of their homes, and shunned. But here's a good example of a communist trying to overcome reality with words and being so fervent in it that he honestly seems to think, or at least acts as like he thinks, biology itself can be overcome with words. This is Anderson quoting Rockwell. Mao had this idea that he knew how to grow grain. He proclaimed that, quote, seeds are happiest when growing together. And so seeds were sown at 5 to 10 times their usual density. It's like Idiocracy with slanted eyes. Plants died, the soil dried out, and the salt rose to the surface. To keep birds from eating grain, sparrows were wiped out, which vastly increased the number of parasites. Erosion and flooding became endemic. Tea plantations were turned to rice fields on the ground that tea was decadent and capitalistic. Hydraulic equipment built to service the new collective farms didn't work and lacked any replacement parts. This led Mao to put new emphasis on localized industry, which was forced to appear in the same areas as agriculture, leading to more chaos. So, this kind of garbage. The number, he says, the number killed is estimated to be between 1 and 5 million. In addition, 4 to 6 million landowners were slaughtered for the crime of being capital owners. And this is how insane that communists can get. And you would assume that it would be even worse with the Jews than with the Chinese. Now let's see what conclusion Anderson draws from this. He says, by now readers are wondering why I'm comparing the intellectuals in China to the Duke Lacrosse case. After all, one involved the starvation and murder of millions of innocent people, and the other was a false rape charge in which the accused did not spend a day in prison. My point, however, is not to compare the enormity of Mao's crimes with what Naifeng and his supporters did. Instead, my larger point is that these two things flow from the same mindset. The narrative is everything. In the case of China, the narrative was that socialism protects and feeds the poor, so anything done in the name of socialism is good, and if there are problems, they must be due either to the remnants of Trotsky's supporters or to capitalist propaganda, since socialism, by definition, cannot oppress the poor. And then he quotes Newsweek's Evan Thomas saying the narrative was correct, but the facts were wrong. And he goes on and on. I've got the link there. It's on the VNN forum. Kievsky chimes in. He says that trying to overcome reality with words is called midrash in Hebrew, doing a midrash on reality. So there's actually a Jewish concept for that. And I think that may refer to their interpretation. They think they can interpret reality out of existence. Now, I want to go back to the book in front of me, which is the Ellis book. And he says that people think political correctness is a recent phenomenon, but it's not. It's much older. He says, Richard Burt, for example, in an essay published in Censorship, a World Encyclopedia, argues that the term political correctness was first introduced by the New Left in the 1960s. Certainly, thinkers of the New Left developed the concept, but long before Marcuse and Derrida and a host of other New Left and postmodernist writers were required reading on campus, we find political correctness established as an ideological criterion of Marxism-Leninism. Official Soviet sources clearly show that the term was in use as early as 1921. So, Derbyshire, who's not known for being an ignorant Jew appeaser, is either ignorant or he's lying. Political correctness has nothing to do with manners, and it's not a recent invention. It goes back to the beginning of communism, or at least the beginning of communism's taking power in Russia. Ellis says, if one takes into account the role of Lenin as the architect of the Soviet Union and his massive influence in shaping Soviet ideology, then a reasonable assumption is that it is to Lenin to whom we must turn in order to find the conceptual origins of political correctness and the term itself. Soviet sources support this assumption. So he's saying Lenin is the root of political correctness, the term, the practice, the thing itself. He says, and remember, this guy is a Slavonic expert. He's an expert in Russian history and Slavonic studies. So we're very lucky that he devoted himself in this direction, studying political correctness. He says, a review of a diverse and large body of Soviet and Western literature written and published throughout the 20th century, which was conducted in preparation for this article, repeatedly identifies the theme of correctness, ideological, political, or theoretical, as a concern of exceptional importance for Marxism, Leninism, and Maoism. And so he says, the range of sources is impressive. Lenin's own writings before and after the start of the 20th century, some early resolutions of Communist Party Congresses, the insights of writers and philosophers, for example, Joseph Berger, George Orwell, Czeslaw Milosz, Stefan Amsterdamski, Leszek Kolakowski, Bulent Vazoni, Arthur Kessler, and Elaine Benson-Son, the writings of Mao and other official Chinese sources, victims of Soviet psychiatric abuse, Chinese and Soviet dissidents, scholarly studies, Western and Soviet propaganda, agitation and media, and the works of some of Russia's greatest writers, most notably Andrei Platonov, Boris Pasternak, Vasily Grossman, and Alexander Solzhenitsyn. So they're all citing correctness. So there was a lot to do with correctness in the original Soviet communism, brought about by the Jewish gangsters, foremost of which was Lenin. Ellis says, Soviet and Chinese manifestations of political correctness are worlds of paranoid suspicion, endless show trials, false confessions, and struggle sessions. Can you see how the Duke rape hoax would fit into that? They have people who belong to a bad class of people. You see, we racialists want separation from niggers because of their behavior. They want separation from white males because they're an officially demonized class, not for anything they objectively did. I mean, if you add up what whites have done, on the whole, it's going to be positive. If you add up what blacks have done, on the whole, it's going to be negative. There's nothing to balance out with blacks, the murder and the rapine. So whites are hostile according to the narrative and the official ideology. They belong to a bad class that must be eliminated according to the communists. The communists are just Jews serving Jewish ethnic interests. And since they run the media, they're able to print stuff like this other story that one of our local blogs picked up on. I don't have the name of it in front of me, but it was a report came out a couple days ago by Ian Gervitz, who he claims he's white. His article's anti-Romney and anti-white bread whites that he claims Romney represents. And he himself says he's white, but he hates white people. His name's Ian Gervitz. This was in Huffington Post. And this is the kind of thing you can print in the so-called mainstream media, where communist hatred of white people, where Judeo-communist hatred of whites is perfectly acceptable. He says, now, before I'm branded some sort of racist, let me be clear. That's what he says before he goes off in this diatribe. I'm white. He's not actually white. He's a Jew. It's nothing I'm proud of. In fact, white people embarrass me. More often than not, I find them clueless, clumsy, soulless, insincere, patronizing, reeking of privilege, occasionally bordering on rude, and quite often fat. So this is a Jew going off on whites. And, of course, nobody is ever allowed to make factual criticism of black behavior, but they're free to say anything they want about whites. This is the danger of allowing communist Jews to take over our country and take over our media and start lecturing us. They're more than willing to kill us. All of their history shows that. So, getting back to Ellis, he says, I'll repeat, Soviet and Chinese manifestations of political correctness are worlds of paranoid suspicion, endless show trials, false confessions, and struggle sessions. They are worlds where the workings of the rational mind are viewed with suspicion, even hatred. And if that isn't a perfect description of the liberal mindset, let alone the communist mindset, I don't know what would be. Where the workings of the rational mind are viewed with suspicion, even hatred. That's a world in which the fact that Reed Seligman was at a different location than the rape supposedly took place didn't matter. They just said, so what? Doesn't matter. It's all how they feel and what ought to be the correct narrative, and that's what matters. Facts be damned. I mean, that's frightening. That's not even reducing humans to an animal level. Animals don't get off track like that. It's a perverse use of human capacity to perceive reality and adapt to it. It's saying we're just going to jam on what we think ought to be, and if you get in our way, we're going to crush you. And God help you if you fall afoul of this monstrous system. And this type of thinking, this type of people dominates our system. That's why we have such miserable things in this country. Because they say, you know, race doesn't matter. Well, the Jews believe it does, but their story for us and their policy for America, where they're the minority, where they're the majority, they exclude all non-Jews, or they at least keep them very much under control in Israel. But where they're the minority, they want to make sure that there is no dominant majority that might do the same thing to them as they do to outsiders and non-Jews in Israel. So their policy for us is multiculturalism. The best way to achieve that is to simultaneously brainwash the people while admitting the third world and electing a new instead of the people electing a new government in Brex Quip, the government will elect a new people. Well, that's what the Jews who control our government are doing with our immigration policy. They are electing a new people that is more tractable and more profitable. So the Goyish trader elite and the Jewish elite make more money off the new people they're electing, and they find it easier to control them politically. The nation falls apart. What do they care? They're rich and secure. Ellis says, for the hapless victims ensnared in the web of communist ideology, it was frequently a matter of life and death. That means it wasn't just losing your job or being ostracized or smeared as it is here in the U.S. right now. It was literally being killed in Russia and China. That's where this Judeo-communism conduces. And the point of what I'm saying today and yesterday is to get you to understand that this type of creature controls our government just as it controlled the Soviet Union and just as it controlled China. Even if, well, in China it didn't directly control it so much, although there was plenty of Jewish influence, but the ideas put forward by Jews were adapted by the Chinese and their own people and failed miserably. But as in the case of South Africa, there was plenty of Jewish influence around Mao. So, but in the Soviet Union, the Jews controlled it directly and did this kind of thing to ordinary whites, you know, destroyed churches and or turned them into communist museums and killed off priests. So, let's see. In the aftermath of the Soviet experiment, Russian scholars have explored the connection between Soviet ideology with its insistence on correctness and the consequences of poor Russian culture. Their observations leave no doubt that political correctness was an ideological criterion which applied to all spheres of intellectual endeavor. They're not even satisfied with the liberal arts and the stuff where words are always used a little more loosely. They take political correctness, i.e. communist totalitarianism, straight into biology. They are absolutely unafraid to use it anywhere. Reality be damned. Having lived under a system where verbal spontaneity and skepticism could sometimes be fatal, and having experienced the party's attempt to police thinking, these former Soviet citizens and their Chinese counterparts offer acute insights into the problem of political correctness in the West today. They repay careful study. So what America's going through right now has already been gone through by the white people of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. So we ought to pay attention to what they've learned from it. Let's see. I think I'll skip through some of this. And we talked about a little bit of it yesterday. Basically, they hit upon a doctrine and then they furiously quash any resistance to it. But I know there's a page here where he sums up his view of political correctness. Well, let's see where it is. Okay. Now, you remember what we talked about yesterday in relation to John Derbyshire's, the Jew Appeaser's article about political correctness. Well, this is a more learned and braver man's summary of what political correctness is, which I'm going to read word for word, and we'll discuss a little bit in between. He's got about 10 points that sum up. He says, the main features which Western political correctness derives from its Soviet and Maoist variants can now be summarized as follows. Right? So this is what PC actually is. Let me take a brief break here. Someone asked me, they say, can you please post links to the Ellis book and the book? I don't have a link to the book. If you look on yesterday's show where I talked about this, I have the title of the book, and I have a link to Scott-Townsend where you can buy it, and somewhere on Amazon where you can buy it and maybe read one review of it. It's actually like kind of a monograph is what it is, called Marxism, Multiculturalism, and Free Speech by Frank Ellis of Leeds University. And now what we're going to do is sum up the 10 main points. The main features of political correctness. One, no limits to the competence of politicians and activists to remold human societies are recognized. Now, I'll break there. I spoofed when I was in trade publishing, and I was able to get a magazine article out about Hillary Clinton that was mocking her back when she was trying to get in socialized medicine. And this is the rationalist spirit, that you don't have to know anything about anything. You can just sit down with a big piece of paper and a nice new pen and just rationalize it out of your head and make something better. And that's the rationalist conceit. And when you combine that with the willingness to kill anyone who stands in the way, you've got political correctness. You've got Judeo-Bolshevist political correctness, communist totalitarianism. Hillary Clinton is far in that regard. Her type does not like any kind of criticism whatsoever. And if they can, they will team up with the Jews to shut it down. She's not the type who's at all intelligent enough to think up policy. She's the type who you take a woman wanting security and whatever, and who has a political bent and a vicious masculine side and turns to the state. Freedom makes no sense, or people being tolerated to do their own thing. That makes no sense to someone like Hillary Clinton. And there are enough of her type that come from our Puritan ancestors from England, absolutely intolerant of other people, who are fit naturally in. Their views dovetail in with the Jews, and they get control of the state, and they turn their moralizing into law, which is the irony, because they're always blaming the... How dare you legislate morality? Well, the dumbass, dirty-eating Christians are trying to legislate morality on the basis of, you know, sexual morals, which at best, you know, first of all, no one can ever track what you're really doing sexually, so how the hell can you get that worried about it in the first place? But, of course, being leftists, they are. But the leftists want every other kind of moralizing into your private life, and they want all kinds of legislation or morals legislated. Like, they don't want anyone operating on their own without government approval, essentially. So there's an existing white mindset that fit nicely in with the Jews, although the Jews determine the ultimate form that this moralizing takes when it's translated into law and policy and government bodies. But Hillary Clinton would be probably the prime example of a purely white communist cunt. Ah, damn, I wasn't going to swear today. A purely white communist bitch who is a true believer, a fanatic, and a fellow traveler, along with the Jews who ultimately set the agenda. And she began life as kind of a Rockwell Republican, and she got she got caught young by some leftist, I guess, minister or Protestant chaplain or some preacher or something like that. And he, you know, he gave her the old guilt and bullshit doctrine, and the Jews claimed another victory for their subversion of the Christian church. So the point is not that there are not whites involved in suppressing other whites. There are plenty of white communists, and you find them primarily in the newspapers and in the academy. But they're not the ultimate ones calling the shots. They may be the face, they may be the George Bushes, they may be the Hillary Clintons who are out front, but they're not the ones thinking up the policies and choosing which terms to use. Those are the party insiders, the ADL and the Jews, who are ultimately determining what the other ones are doing. But this is the arrogance and the insanity is, well, you know, when the people call themselves, we're the chosen people, obviously reality has no meaning to them. So no limits to the competence of politicians and activists to remold human societies are recognized. So they're just stupid, arrogant fucks. They think they can do anything, and reality will just conform to what they want, or they'll crush anyone who observes that there's a gap. There's no area of human cultural endeavor which cannot be, quote, deconstructed and improved. All versions of political correctness are genuine manifestations of ideology, and the definitions provided by Apter, Arendt, Francis Heller, Kirk, and Lynn. That's number one. Number two, political correctness denies objective truth or something very close to it. And we saw that illustrated. That's why I called up the Anderson article on Duke. I mean, it was the unusual case in which the DA comes forward and not merely says that they're not going to press charges, but says these people are innocent. So the nigger was lying. And they never touched her, let alone raped her. And the 88 faculty members at one of the most prominent and well-respected institutions in the country still won't back off. They still won't admit they're wrong. So these are the kind of depraved monsters that people are foolishly paying their kids literally $40,000 a year to educate. What kind of an education are you going to get from a Sally Deutsch? From some Jew who won't even accept that whites aren't rapists when it's completely proved that they're not. These people aren't going to educate you. They hate you. And you're paying them money. Only certain types, this is number three, only certain, third main feature of Western political correctness, which is really Jewish Semitical correctness. Only certain types of art, literature, and scientific research and thinking are permissible. Soviet ideologues believed, mistakenly, that they could co-opt the tradition of the 19th century Russian literature for their own ends. Rather than acknowledging the grandeur of the great canon, postmodernists have chosen to attack the canon with the aim of deconstruction through leveling. Both Western and Soviet Maoist versions accept the need for truth and facts to be censored. Both Western and Soviet Maoist versions accept the need for facts and truth to be censored if they conflict with politically correct aims. Reality must yield to Jew-communist ideology every time. When Harvard professor Barbara Johnson, as part of the AWARE campaign, actively working against racism and ethnocentrism, declared that professors should have less freedom of expression than writers and artists because professors are supposed to be creating a better world, Beard and Cerf, 1992, she reveals her full commitment to the spirit of Soviet socialist realism and Leninist Parteinost, which I think he's saying is kind of the original word for political correctness. Whereas the Soviet Communist Party was brutal in regard to censoring forbidden manuscripts, killing and imprisoning writers without hesitation, more diverse approaches are favored in the West. The following can be noted: outright suppression of manuscripts by a publisher, even when the author has been earlier informed that the publication will proceed, as in the case of Chris Brand's book on the G-Factor, that's IQ stuff. Intimidation of publishers by left-wing extremists who often adopt a guise of, quote, anti-racism or, quote, anti-fascism. Failure or refusal on the part of university librarians to consider certain titles for collection development, a very effective long-term form of censorship. Refusal to review certain books. Ignoring a book even when it sells well. Organizing a discussion panel to attack an author or publication. Ensuring that the author under attack or advocate of certain views has minimal time to respond. This is a favorite technique of the BBC. Britain's state-owned television station, when a politically incorrect opinion or book cannot be ignored, since to do so merely draws attention to the silence of the state media. Ideological and political attacks on the institution of free speech, frequently based on the straw man fallacy that free speech is not an absolute. No man-made institution is. So yeah, they're always trying to chip away at any kind of protection or legal sponsorship that anyone who could criticize them or even try to live apart and differently from the way they want uses to defend himself. They want, this is what totalitarianism means. They want to control not only your body, but your soul and your thoughts. They want to control every atom of you and anything metaphysical that pertains to you also. And so this is the struggle that we face in America today, and there are a few differences, but they're technical, they're superficial, they're not substantial differences between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. The same mindset and the same blood set are trying to lord it over normal white people, like you and me listening to this. So this is how deep this stuff runs, and we have the part of their charade and their sham is having these clowns affect to talk about their techniques and their practices, but dismiss them as something in real world. It's just manners. It's just manners gone a little too far. No, it has nothing to do with manners. It's not an excess of sympathy or solicitousness for minority. It has nothing to do with that. It's about we've created a virtual world in our heads, and we are going to force it on everybody else, whether you like it or not. If you resist, we will crush you. And all right, that was a very extensive third point, a third main feature. Another main feature: use of the print and broadcast media to vilify and demonize those who break any taboos prescribed in paragraph 3. Well, have we not seen that firsthand? We do a rally to protest blacks raping and murdering white people. We are called extremists and haters. Always, every time. The media never deviate. The media are wholly in the grip of an alien power. They're in the grip of people who are fanatics, who are ideological, and who brook no opposition to their tyranny. And they don't give a damn about white victims of Jew-loosed niggers. They are far angrier at whites who bring the subject up, because all it does is draw attention to the gap between reality and what they claim. White's job is to breed with coloreds and pass out of existence as a race, and they are never ever to think in racial terms, and that's never to be allowed in the communist press. If America were run by outright declared communists, would the media be one whit different than it is today? No, it wouldn't. It would be exactly the same. He says, and just to amplify that fourth point, he says again, use of the print and broadcast media to vilify and demonize those who break any taboos prescribed in paragraph 3. This is important in the West, since totalitarian violence used by the Soviet Union is not currently an option. Okay, not currently an option, but believe me, what they would like to do is simply round up people who are politically incorrect and murder them. But America has a legacy not only of free speech, First Amendment, but of free guns, Second Amendment. So what they do is a dual attack on those and any other legal instrument that can be used to protect or sustain the white culture that the Jews hate. That's why the Jews are always on the side of the people who want to take away your gun and your words. They want to put tape over your mouth, they want to steal all your guns, and put you in the position of being a slave to them, so that they can use you for their purposes. The Jews as a race are rather like one of those evil whites that they portray in those crime shows on A&E. They're like sickos driving around with a van that they lock little girls up in, and they take them off somewhere and then they rape them and kill them. That's the Jews' attitude towards whites. They're complete predators. And they use all means at their disposal to lie and kill people. Fifth feature of political correctness: We find exceptional importance attached to the need to establish and to maintain correct theoretical approaches. For contemporary political correctness, domination of discourse, symbols, words, and usage is all important. And this gets back to what I said. The Jews ensure that in their media, which is basically all mass media, apart from the internet, only their terms are used. And that's why, as we've documented time after time, when something happens that's racial, always the same terms are used to describe the victims and the criminals and the people who talk about it who are outside of the Judeosphere, like us. We're extremists and haters for talking about the incredible amount of black-on-white crime that has recurred as a result of the Jews removing our freedom of association and calling it civil rights back in the 60s. We talk about that, we're evil, because we talk about it. They're not evil for doing things that cause 40,000 white women to be raped a year. We're evil for talking about it. That's what communism is on a day-to-day sense. Think how warped and sick you have to be to call people evil who are talking about evil and talk about what causes it and trying to remove the cause. We can simply solve all the racial problems that, and today there was another article put out that quoted the Jew Potok down at SPLC about how, oh, there's worse and worse racial problems. Hey, the racial problems are caused by mixing the races. So they're kind of talking out of both sides of their mouth. They created a situation they knew would result in all these racial problems. They did it because the end state they seek is further that way. And the end state they seek is no white people existing, no even potential political threat to the Jews as the dominant power in society, and bigger, fatter, stupider consumer units everywhere you look. The better to line the coffers of the owners of these giant companies who are disproportionately Jews. That's what's actually going on. But so exceptional importance of the theory and words dominating reality. Reality is one way, but we can change it with words. That's just wrong. But what they can do is inflict a lot of pain on people who don't go along with their verbal agenda. And their verbal agenda is the day-to-day working of their political agenda. That's why it's so important, as I've said, and I really don't think most white nationalists are intelligent enough to understand how important it is to fight the battle on the verbal level and never, ever use their terms. Always use your own terms. Always frame the argument to benefit you. It so happens we're on the side of reality. But you can't use their terms and win. Their terms are devised so that you lose. And the conservatives accept that because they're cowards. So they're happy to begin every article they write with five paragraphs of, I'm not a homophobe, and then in the last sentence, you know, maybe one or two facts about homosexual behavior. That's not good enough. That's not how you win. You don't win by defending yourself against liars. You win by attacking the liars, by calling them liars, by labeling them what they are, just as they label us what we're not. You take their label for us, you reverse it, you get the truth. But all we have to do is call them Jews and communists and say this is what they're doing and why. And then we have to organize to thwart them. So it's very deep, deep stuff. There's no light thing what you call something. Very, very important that you get it by the right name. And it's very, very important that when you see someone else trying to force you to use a name that is not applicable, that you don't go along with it. Because in that way you corrupt your soul, and that weakens you. It makes it easier for you to do it the next time with some other thing. It may seem like a little thing, but it isn't. It's a very big thing. All right, and the sixth feature of political correctness, the role of a demon figure, either the class enemy or currently the white heterosexual male. Now, here's where this dovetails into McDonald very nicely. We know that Jews hate whites. They view them as competitors. They have an alien society to what the Jews want, and they resent us. And so, like I said the other day, trying to make a line, you know, the only ads on TV in which white males are treated with respect are army ads. Why is that? Every other ad, whites are portrayed as doofy, goofy, nerdy losers, in contrast to cool, athletic, musical blacks. And white girls are shown with blacks, and they're shown with every other kind of muddy minority. but white males are shown as goofballs. And yet, when it comes to the Army, why all of a sudden they flip around and that's the one place whites are treated with? Why is it? Well, they want you to go be fodder and die for Israel. They have no respect for you, but they're willing to use you and get you killed for their own benefit. Everything you see on TV is for the Jews' benefit. If you don't understand that, you shouldn't be watching TV. You probably shouldn't be watching it anyway. But you have to raise your kids up and train them that this is what's going on here and fight back. And there is absolutely no doubt, and the Duke example fits in there, the white male is the demonized figure. And it's for that reason that you'll often hear the Jewish comedians like Jon Stewart. And most of the comedians are either Jewish or they're always following the Jewy agenda. In fact, I played one George Carlin quip. Well, let me get back to that in a minute. Let me just say that the Jews always... politically correct comedy means that at the end of the day, when you can make fun of anyone you want, but it's always kept at a personal level when it's of a black or a Jew or something. But when it's white, it's at a theoretical level. They're funny because they're white. And whites have no real complaints against blacks that 400 years of slavery doesn't trump. And you'll often see the writers for Jew Jon Stewart in The Daily Show making reference to that if ever it arises that some white makes a systemic complaint about what's going on in America and says, hey, this thing's set up to aid blacks and to hurt me. Oh, sure, that makes up for 400 years of slavery. Now, George Carlin is, you know, one of these pseudo kind of radicals, and I like his voice, and I think he's actually pretty funny, and I included a clip from him today in the warm-up hour of music, but there's other clips I have that I'll play in future days where he, you know, he's trying to be Mr. Politically Incorrect and go off on stuff and find new targets like every comedian would. And what does he go off on? He goes off on white males. He goes off on white males. And just like all the rest of them, the pseudo-rebellious thing, the anti-corporate, the Jew has all kinds of sidetrackings, corporate profitable Jew-safe sidetrackings for white people who are either waking up or want to exercise some of their more violent or radical impulses. He's always got a way to turn that into something that's profitable to him. Well, this, what we're talking about here today, explains to you what's going on and suggests the way to a real revolution and a real rebellion. You want something to rebel against? Political correctness is it. Jewish communism. Tyranny over whites exercised by Jewish communists. That's a good thing to rebel against. And you rebel in a day-to-day basis by not accepting the words and the frames and the terms that the Jew uses and imposing your own on him. And it's so bad that this hatred that produced hundreds of millions of corpses last century doesn't even have a name. So I termed up Loxism, which is as good as anything since there ain't any other thing out there. So whites are so dumb, they haven't been able to come up with a name for the Jewish hatred of whites. The hatred that defines the modern world. And I said, if someone else wants to come up, we want to have a committee of white people meet and decide on a word, I would be happy to go along with it, but there has to be a goddamn word. So Loxism is the word, until a better word replaces it. But goddamn it, that's the hatred. That is the motivation. That is the drive that defines the modern world. And don't tell me it doesn't. I've seen it firsthand. Every station in life. VNN, to working professionally, to writing stuff in college. I've seen it firsthand. I know what's going on. It's Jewish communists trying to impose their way of living on the rest of us. And even to say Jewish communists would be redundant. You're repeating yourself. It's the same fucking thing. As Stephen Wise, one of the biggest Jews, biggest name rabbi of the first half of the 20th century, in the same way that Mencken was the biggest journalist of the first half of the 20th century, he said, some call it communism, I call it Judaism. Communism, Judaism, same thing. So Wise is just like the Nazis who always spoke and acted against Judeo-Bolshevism. Right? It's like they say Judeo-Christian, Judeo-Communist, Judeo-Bolsheviks, the Jewish communist. It's essential that you understand this. And you fight it. Fight it verbally. Go along with these lies. Don't accept. Don't tell jokes about white trash and blah, blah, blah. And, people will only hear nigger jokes. If white trash exists, did niggers not exist? Why is it better to use one but not the other? Another thing I was thinking, I listened to the broadcast yesterday and I was thinking, were there any points I didn't make? Well, one point I didn't make was,
I did half make it, but Derbyshire said, oh, it's a matter of manners, and, you know, people, it's good that races are becoming more decorous in their treatment. No. All, what it was it went from whites talking about niggers to everybody else shitting on whites. It was a racial transfer of power affected by the Jew who rewrote the laws and bought up the media and redefined everything. So it went from whites being able to call niggers niggers to nobody being able to use nigger, no white being able to use nigger, no acknowledgement that niggers exist, and everybody perfectly free to go off in white trash, like the article by the Jew Gervitz I just read. Gervitz, G-U-R-V-I-T-Z. Right? So, what you had was a shift in power. But of course, Jew employed, Jew appeaser, all I have to say is really is Englishman. Well, that's not fair, because Ellis is English too, so my bigotry got the better of me there for a minute. But, I came by my bigotry honestly, and I'll stick with it, but I always praise people who deserve praise, and Ellis deserves praise, and Derbyshire deserves to have his head cut off because he's a punk and he's a Jew-appeasing, race-mixing piece of shit who's deliberately lying about the origins of political correctness. And don't think for a minute he's not aware of this monograph, and he's not aware of Ellis and Ellis's treatment over in Britain. Ellis is a man. Derbyshire is a Kirbyshire. He's a servile cur, walking the street, looking for scraps, and all he deserves is the side of your boot and his ribs. He's a punk. Turning to the text. The seventh feature, we're in the seventh of a list of 10 features of political correctness. And six was the role of a demon figure, which is the white male. Political correctness has, this is point seven, to paraphrase Tome, I guess, T-H-O-M, I'm not sure how that's pronounced. If it's German, it's Tome. Turn the world into language and strives for absolute control over the dictionary. That's what I've been saying for seven fucking years now. I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, they and you know, I used to harp on 20 years now. I graduated in 88. I used to write about the stuff 84 to 88. I would write columns about the abuse of language. I was always hypersensitive to how they're using terms to what's the best way to put it? I'm not even cover up. Yeah, it's partly to cover up reality, partly to pretend that reality is other than it actually is, and partly to intimidate you into not fighting back with accurate words of your own. It's a little bit of all of those things, but it's essentially an attempt to use words to gain the upper hand. It's liars using words to gain upper hands over honest people. Politically correct language is the form that lying takes when it comes to political words. And pretty much in a totalitarian state, everything is political. Like the feminist personal is political. There's no issue, there's no sector that isn't politicized. And that's to create a society, the double clutch, where you're, oh, am I allowed to do this? Am I allowed to say that? Am I allowed to have those thoughts? Does anyone else agree with me? No, they don't. I turn on the telecult and all I saw was this, so I better go along with that. It's an attempt to scare you out of your natural responses and your natural honesty and into putting on their straitjacket so you can't do anything. Put on your verbal straitjacket and go out in the insane asylum they've made of America. And this is what's going on. Envy is exploited to an unusual degree. Well, yeah, sure. That's part of setting class against class. I mean, if you're going to put a chip on people's shoulders, you're going to set class against class, you have to make them angry at each other. You make them angry by telling them, well, those guys took something from you. If it's niggers, they say, oh, they took your freedom. And you tell them a lot of half-truths. It's like, hey, you'd be starving in Africa and have tsetse flies in your eyes. And you'd have malaria and you'd have the rest of this crap if it wasn't for whites dragging you over here and coming up with cures for this stuff. So they tell lies to the blacks about whites, not least about which they tell them lies about their inherent capacities. Same with women. They tell them lies about, here's what you really want. Here's what you're really capable. Oh, anything that men do, women can do too. Sure, 1 out of 10,000 women can do what your average man can, but the rest can't. Same with niggers. Yeah, there's a talented 10th, and the rest are pretty much useless. But they set people at odds. They set teeth on edge. The politics of malocclusion, they get people angry and stirred up and pissed off for all the wrong reasons. When if the Jews were the good people that they present themselves as being, they would act wholly differently. They would tell white blacks, look, they're biological facts, and you may not like them, but this is how it is. You're not as intelligent on average as these people. You're more violent. You're more destructive. You need to be controlled, lest you bring down the people who, you know, lest you kill the golden white goose. Right? This goose will lay golden eggs if y'all can keep your goddamn Vic under control. Now, since we know you really can't do that on your own, we're going to have to impose some pretty strict laws on you. One is you stay out of the golden goose area. We're going to chop your doggy little fro off. You know, and we don't want you mixing or messing with the white people. We want you in your own areas. You stay in your own areas. You mind your own business, you'll be okay. You come out of those areas in the human areas, we're going to have problems. That's how niggers need to be spoken to. If they were truly loved and appreciated and someone wanted the best for them, that's what they'd have. But they are not fit. They have not evolved. They are not evolved to be primetime players. They're not ready for primetime. They're still on primate time. They need a few 100,000 more years of seasoning before they're ready to step up to the human level. And we don't have that kind of time to waste. And they're laying waste to our people, so we have to fight them off. Stirred up angry people who've been lied to about their capacities by the Jews controlling the country for their own ends. So the Jews hate blacks every bit as much as they hate whites. But they're not against using the blacks to destroy the whites, just as they're not against using the stupid Christians they hate to destroy the whites. Using other people is the common denominator. It's the common factor in Jewish relations to other peoples. They use them for their own advantage by telling them lies and setting them at odds with themselves and with others. Jews are essentially the demonic principle embodied in one nasty, foul little race, and it's set free in the earth, I guess, for the rest of the people to try to deal with. That's what I would say if I were a spiritual type, because that's exactly what it is. In any settled situation, if you figure out what would fuck it up the worst, you will have the policy advocated by Big Jew. Every single time. Now, that was the eighth envy, and nine is freedoms guaranteed in Western societies are exploited in an attempt to destroy those freedoms, while arguing that these freedoms are a sham. Free speech, equality before the law, freedom of assembly. He says that's one of the main features of political correctness. So yeah, they use the freedom of speech and their individual rights to gain power as a group, to buy up all the media, to redefine all the terms. And one of the terms that they redefine, and he's saying they use their freedom to destroy freedom while arguing freedom doesn't exist. How do they do that? What's an example? Freedom of speech. Well, what they do is they give awards to pornographers. They produce movies that celebrate, you know, the People versus Larry Flint, Boogie Nights. These are two examples I've heard E. Michael Jones use. They use those to advance the idea that Jewish pornography, and almost all pornography, is Jewish in origin. It's produced by Jews. Pornography is free speech. But real free speech is hate speech. So they redefine, over decades, they subtly, slowly, and then more quickly and more loudly, they redefine ancient protected freedoms as something else. And all of a sudden, this has a dual benefit of pornography. They not only can outlaw any criticism of themselves and their communist totalitarianism on the part of whites as hate speech, they can protect and promote their own pornography that makes them money as free speech. Well, and at the same time it makes them money, it degrades white morals and destroys white families. So it's a twofer. It's more than that even. They get every possible benefit from doing this kind of thing, and that's why formal organized Jewry represented by the ADL, which is Israel in America, that's why they give their Torchlight Award to pornographers like Hugh Hefner and Larry Flint, and I think a couple of others, some other, Mo Dalitz or something like that. They give awards to pornographers because pornographers give them money and they in turn protect the pornographers with their press releases and the movies they produce. One hand washes the other. Both hands have Aryan America by the throat. So that's why we say no Jews, just right. You have to get rid of all these people en masse, because they're a nasty mess of tent caterpillars on the beautiful American, oh, linden tree, shall we say. That's where my name comes from, apparently. Anyway, let's see. I don't actually know if linden trees have tent caterpillars, by the way. I'm just going to assert it like a communist and kill you if you say otherwise. And so we get to the final point here, the tenth main feature of political correctness, which is, as Joe Soberman said, Semitical correctness. Do you see how I give credit to him for coming up with the term, and I use the term actually more than he does? That's because I always go with whatever the best term is to fight back, and that's the way others should act. They should use these terms or come up with better terms themselves and never accept the terms as laid out by Jews, because you can't win when you're playing by their rules. Tenth one, the Soviet and Chinese Communist Party seized power and proceeded on the basis of the tabula rasa, or year zero. In the West, we are experiencing a process of slow and incremental Sovietization. Our year zero would be about, to pick a date, 1965, when the immigration went through, and the immigration flipped to 90% non-white, and the blacks were, you know, liberated, so to speak. You know, if you're going to liberate the niggers, what are niggers going to do once they're liberated? That's kind of the question you want to ask before you set them loose. If I take this dog off the leash, what's it going to do? Oh, it's going to lope along and stick its tongue out and maybe take a squat on something. Okay, well, I guess we could let it off. Well, this dog is rabid. It's going to run over that baby and bite its face off and bite the woman and give her rabies. Well, then I don't really want to let it off the leash. I'd rather take a pistol out and shoot it. Or sell it to Mike Vick. You know, this love of abstractions over reality is very characteristic, not just of the communist that the libertarian William Anderson describes, but is actually pretty, he himself is guilty of the same thing in a very modest and Christian type of way. He lets his love of the abstraction state and individual override the biological reality of generalizable group differences between blacks and whites. He does it whether good or bad, and he's obviously not tyrannical in the way that the communists are. It's still a distortion and a danger, as he will find when the kids that he thinks are just black-colored individuals grow up to be niggers. It's been found over and over. So libertarianism, as I've said before, is a distortion like communism, but in the opposite direction. The really tough, hardcore liars become collectivist communists, and the really soft, wussy, love-em-alls become libertarians. But sanity is in the middle. Sanity is in the middle. It says people are both individuals and members of groups. And sanity says you can't live without generalizing, and yet you must always test your general theories against the evidence. And that way you can't get too far off track. You understand what I'm saying? That way you don't go off and murder millions and millions of people and go, oops, I'm sorry, my bad. And you understand, the Jews who institute a lot of this know what the effect will be, but a lot of the Aryans who go along with them don't. Some of them do, and they are every bit as guilty as the Jews. But some of them are simply what are known as dupes or fellow travelers. They're just too dumb, and they're the ones who could conceivably hear what I'm saying and get some benefit and wake up from their delusions. But the delusion of rationalist control, like he says, where you can simply, you know, sit down and you don't really have to understand anything. You just make something new. But make your own system and run with that. This is political correctness. This is communism. And then he's got a little conclusion here. Let's look at that a little bit, and then we'll probably wrap up for the day. I don't have any. I'm doing a little more writing tonight. I want to write a little bit also. And I wanted to make a couple more points about political correctness, and then we'll leave this subject alone in future broadcasts. We'll try to figure out what went wrong with our call-in, because it sounded good to me on the line, but evidently it was too choppy. maybe 30 seconds of it were good and the rest got chopped up. So it may have been a connection on his end or it may have been something technical. But anyway, let me read a little of the conclusion of the wonderful Frank Ellis, who is an Englishman apparently, living in Great Britain, was or is working at the University of Leeds, where he's a member of the faculty in the Department of Russian and Slavonic Studies. And this is just wonderful stuff. And like I said yesterday, I'll repeat today, I happen to know, because I'm an insider, privy to all kinds of very, very interesting information, that there is going to be a major motion picture devoted to the subject of political correctness coming our way before the year is out. And I just might arrange a private showing of that movie in Kirksville, Missouri, if I can find a venue. And maybe you might want to do the same and host a little discussion much along the lines of what you've heard here the last hour. Something to think about. Like I said, major motion picture concerning the Jewish roots of political correctness, which is another name for deviation from the line of the communist Jews who created mass murderous tyranny in the Soviet Union and who control America today. Now, let's look at the conclusion here. He says, emerging into the wider public domain at the end of the 1980s and early 1990s, the term political correctness, much to the surprise and chagrin of those who used it, rapidly became associated with the Pharisee and the tyrant. As early as 1992, the compilers of the official politically correct dictionary and handbook were quick to spot the danger and tried to blunt the attack, warning their readers that the term politically correct, co-opted by the white power elite as a tool for attacking multiculturalism, is no longer politically correct. Baron Cerf, 1992. Attacking political correctness with some vigor in Culture of Complaint, Robert Hughes nevertheless felt obliged to balance his criticism with the invention of patriotic correctness, which he assured us was as bad as political correctness. He's an Austrian critic. Richard Burt's explanation of the origins of political correctness is something that was, quote, used ironically against other leftists as a critique of moralism and preachiness, also shows a certain lack of imagination and understanding of what is at stake. For if political correctness was simply a question of ridiculing preachiness or adopting poses, then one could just ignore it. On the basis of material cited and discussed here, political correctness goes way beyond mere finger-wagging. In its Maoist variant, it represents an extreme form of intellectual violence designed to break an individual's will and compel him to submit to the will of the collective. And that part we haven't gotten into, and I will go into that on a future radio show. Because, there, as I said on show one, there's some very, on the August 21st, there are some very interesting examples of it. In China's gookish implementation of the Judeo-communist principles of political correctness, which is Semitical correctness. Harry Wu's insight into his own ordeal in the Laogai recognizes the brutal simplicity of what his tormentors were trying to achieve. This is Harry Wu speaking. Suddenly, the traditional practice of foot binding came to mind. We have switched to head binding, I thought. It is no longer the fashion to bind a woman's feet, but they bind a person's thoughts instead. That way, the mind can't move freely. That way, ideas all take on the same size and shape, and thinking becomes impossible. That's why they arrested me. That's why they want to change me. That's why they forced me to reform. That's Wu, Harry Wu, from 1994. Western versions, this is again is Ellis, Western versions lack concentration camps for re-education and reform through labor, yet they indisputably involve wholly unacceptable levels of censorship and intellectual violence to those who dissent from multicultural orthodoxy. Race awareness courses in American universities are just one example, CORS 2000. Now, even here he's still leaving a little out. It's really the moral degradation of people that is ultimately the aim, because it's kind of the best guarantee of future non-resistance. because if it's simply intellectual, you might reverse at any time. But if you have a moral breakdown and a moral failure, people are more really spiritual beings than they are material. Now, I don't know how that spirit, what it's composed of or anything, and I'm not religious, but I mean, ultimately, people are kind of, you know, they're kind of lights. They're dimmer or they're brighter, and it can be dimmed or brightened as a result of what they experience in the world. And this is aimed at corrupting your soul. It's attempting to intimidate you, and make you cower and make you shrink. And it's to deman you, to unman you, to reduce you, and that's why it has to be fought. That's why it's no small matter when you exceed in their lies and signal that by adopting their phraseology and their terms. You exceed in your own destruction when you do that. And that is their intent. Humans are so constituted that you can't play a rigged game, you can't pretend to be something for a long period of time without becoming that something. So if you go along and play and say, oh, all right, we'll just pretend, we'll just do this. Well, that has greater and graver implications than you realize. And most people don't really think about it. They just recognize there's a power orientation. They have more power, so we better do what they say. But there are very grave implications of that for you, the individual soul, and us as a collective souls that compose an Aryan society. We can stand a lot of physical punishment. We can stand hard circumstances. But we can't stand being destroyed from our spirit and our soul outward. And this is what the Jews, who brought the world this political correctness, intend to do to us with it. Do you understand that? Let's look at a little more here and then we'll wrap up, because it's a little bit after 5. So he says, well, we don't have concentration camps in the West yet for re-education reform through labor. We do have plenty of diversity and sensitivity training, which is a lighter version of the same thing. He says, moreover, the threat and use of physical violence is always there if the left feels that some recalcitrant academic needs to be taught a lesson. Orchestrated mob rule, which was used to intimidate professors Michael Levin, J. Philip Rushton, Chris Brand, Arthur Jensen, and Hans Eysenck, is straight out of the Maoist canon of street thuggery deployed against Chinese intellectuals during the Cultural Revolution. Burt, citing others to the effect that no academics have been prevented from teaching or dismissed by any university administration, is disingenuous and demonstrably wrong. I mean, that's the thing is, and this goes back to something I've said for so long. I mean, this process has been underway. Anderson says for 4 decades. I'd say probably even longer than that, because 4 decades ago is when they took power in the 60s. But there were plenty of them in there in the 50s for all their bitching about McCarthyism. And what they do is the Jews dominate every step of the process related to hiring and firing and publishing, which are all related. So eventually, if you dominate that for long enough, nothing can even get in the door. They're the gatekeepers. They just keep this shit out, even down to the level of students. I'm persuaded that's going on. And so, you know, you get to a point where the books are never produced, so, well, the librarians aren't refusing to stock. Well, the book's not even produced. The writer didn't even write it because he knew it wouldn't be published. And that's how bad it is. So it's a very full and deep thing. In the United States Kingdom, Ray Honeyford, headmaster of a school in Bradford, an inner city area with a large concentration of school children from the Indian subcontinent, was subjected to a sustained campaign of physical violence and bureaucratic intimidation because he highlighted the failures of multicultural education. Some 20 years later, he's been thoroughly vindicated, as some of his erstwhile critics in the government now admit. Yet this is small comfort to a decent man whose career was destroyed in its prime. The most recent example is the death of Pim Fortuyn, Fortuyn or Fortuyn, a former Dutch university professor who was murdered by an extremist because of his views. Furthermore, anyone who's taught at an American university can testify that enormous psychological pressure is brought to bear on academics and students to submit to the general line on all issues dealing with multiculturalism, race, and feminism. I can certainly attest to that. The atmosphere is not one which is conducive to asking awkward questions, to say the least. It is one of coercion. Yes, 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 and yes again. As Robert Lifton has noted in his pioneering study of thought reform, the message of coercion is you must change and become what we tell you to become, or else. The threat embodied in the or else may be anything from death to social ostracism, any form of physical or emotional pain. True. Nor, given the way tenure is awarded in American universities, are we likely to encounter many dismissal cases. Any academic who publicly or privately dissented on issues relating to multiculturalism would be placing his chances of securing tenure in grave jeopardy. Dissent would lead to negative reviews in the tenure process, the result being denial of tenure, and administrative preemptive strike, in effect de facto dismissal. Most academics, even with tenure, prefer to stay silent. In the strict sense of the term, the question of dismissal does not therefore arise. So they're self-censoring. And even the ones like Kevin MacDonald who have tenure are attacked by these people. The SPLC sent Heidi Beirich, one of their instigators, out there to interview the faculty and try to stir up hatred of Kevin MacDonald. And so far, he's tenured, and there's nothing they can do in that regard, but they have got him fired from teaching lower-level courses of a certain type, or at least the administration is saying that he has to come up with new courses on the pretext that enrollment for his low-level courses was too low. So they attack anyone that they even suspect of disagreeing with their line. Then he goes on and says, that said, attempts to have been made to get university administrations to fire tenured faculty for expressing politically incorrect opinions. So far, these attempts appear to have failed, but they have caused a great deal of stress to the victims and resulted in much emotional and intellectual energy being wasted. In view of the legal security that tenure affords in American and Canadian universities, one is tempted to conclude that university administrations that attempt to fire faculty do not do so in the hope that they'll succeed, though that would be desirable, but rather with the express intention of causing the victims as much misery as possible. Remember, Canada is where we've seen our own Tomas Winicki thrown in jail for citing crime stats from Toronto, which show that, you know, coloreds are committing the crimes in Toronto. He says that on an American website, on an American server, and he gets thrown in jail in Canada. That's the kind of world the Jewish totalitarians want to build. And the conservatives will never acknowledge that Jews are the source and the force behind political correctness. Because, like the servile English cur John Derbyshire, they work for Jews, and they dare not criticize Jews. Maybe another show will go over the article he wrote saying just that in so many words in his interview with Juicy.com, a Jew site. He says basically universities are abandoning the presumption of innocence, a vital feature of Western jurisprudence. The mere fact of your criticizing multiculturalism renders you guilty and liable to punishment. And this is just so good, I don't think I need to give any excuse. I'm just going to read the rest of this. There's a couple more pages, and then I'll make a couple final comments, and we'll be done. So, nor were the debates over political correctness in the early 1990s something peripheral to the future of higher education, as Bert has also suggested, but something fundamental. So debates over political PC in the early 90s were fundamental. Whatever caused the left-wing radical supports in the Rainbow Coalition, and these days he need not be very left or very radical, his relative approach to knowledge, his commitment to the truth ought to be rather than the one that is, his barely concealed loathing of individual excellence, the belief that in the collective or community resides superior wisdom, his loathing of free speech, which he naturally exploits to the full, and his ready acceptance of a completely politicized education system are demonstrably the offspring of communist systems. So political correctness is communism, and communism is Judaism, as a Jew said.
Jew Rabbi Stephen Wise said, communism is Judaism. Some call it communism. I call it Judaism. So political correctness equals Semitical correctness equals communism equals Judaism equals no fucking good for you, white listener. You get it? Nothing about manners. It's got nothing to do with that. PC totalitarian communism run by Jews for their interest right over your hide, right over your families, the bodies of your families and your ancestors. Breaking the chain of Aryan tradition and Aryan life. Political correctness provides the deep structure, the base on which the superstructure of multiculturalism at all can be raised. Political correctness, in other words, is something serious. That's been the whole point of the last 2 days talking about this. It's very, very serious. There's nothing light or superficial about it at all. Some of Bert's points have been taken up by Helena Kennedy, a well-known left-wing Scottish lawyer, supporter of all things multicultural and feminist. Recently, as May 2002, she restated views from the mid-90s, namely that political correctness is an invention of the right. There's plenty of evidence, as I've tried to demonstrate in this article, that by the time the Soviet Union collapsed in 91, in any case, well before the vast majority of Westerners, whatever their political allegiances, had heard of it, political correctness was established as an indispensable element in the theoretical struggle of Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, and the New Left. So Russia, China, and America in the 60s. Correctness, after all, that is the correct analysis of Western bourgeois societies and the correct solutions to their ills, has always been the basis on which the left, new or old, has staked its claim to order our lives and rebuild the societies in the name of social justice. So, Kennedy's assertion was made either out of ignorance or, more probably, because she understands only too well that the demonstrable and verifiable debt owed by multiculturalism and feminism to Lenin and Mao does nothing to make the public congenial towards the whole multicultural experiment and its oppressive legislation. They call it multiculturalism instead of Maoism because it's easier to sell, but there's no substantial difference. Responses other than direct denial can also be noted. The frequency with which we encounter terms such as correct orientation, correctness, as well as the use of the adjective and verb correct and correctly in official Chinese sources underlines the extraordinary efforts made by the Chinese Communist Party to control people's thoughts and feelings. Yet the studies consulted for this article betray a marked reluctance to draw conclusions about the communist origins of political correctness and the manner in which it has migrated to the West. Not a single work cited in this article, and which was published after 1990, that is at the time when the debate over political correctness in the West was raging, has actually discussed the connection between Maoist notions of correctness and the American campus, even if only to deny or attack any connection. So he's saying that basically the stuff you see on the Academy in America traces right back to Mao's China. In many ways, maybe even more than in the Soviet Union, although, you know, pretty much similar for the most part. There's also a thing I would point out. In political correctness, shortly after it came, and the deep roots of it were never pointed out, but because it represented a half unpolitically correct term. The correct term would have been Semitical correctness, since it's Jewish in origin, but at least it was some sort of term recognizing the reality that there's some force out there that's forcing us to be one way. So even to that limited extent, political correctness was a threat. The term was a threat to political correctness, the practice. So to blunt and counter that threat, alternative people who were politically correct and in favor of political correctness as techniques and practices either 1. Pretended that political correctness did not exist, 2. Pretended that the right wing had its own version of political correctness, or 3. They redefined and misdefined political correctness as, well, to the extent that political correctness was unpopular with people, they defined it as political correctness. So you'd be politically correct if you were being dissolute, say, in the same manner the politically correct were already pushing you to be. So if you wore the wrong kind of clothes, or you did something
rebellious in a corporate Judeo-sanitized, Judeo-profitable way, that could even be called politically correct, because they wanted to push you. The best example of that would be in the movie Politically Correct, where the source of political correctness is identified as David Spade, who's a frat brother who skippered Hitler's catamaran during the war. So, for a brief shining moment, the fog rolls back and we get a little spotlight on this incredibly powerful phenomenon, but then quickly the fog machine squirts up a bunch of new fog and occludes it again and obscures the view again. Right? You understand what I'm saying? I think you do. That's why it's better to dispense with the whole thing and call it Semitical correctness. And so, yeah, the phenomenon the term points out is there, and don't allow the Jews to redefine it from what it is. And to help do that, call it Semitical correctness. Identify the source as the communist Jews. Okay, let's see. So he talks about in his conclusion the connection of the communists, and we'll go into that on a different one because they're dramatic, as I've said. He says, let's see. Marxism-Leninism, from which political correctness is derived, manifests a completely different order of correctness and application from any other political system. The danger arises from the totalitarian aspirations of Marxism-Leninism-Maoism. That is, they want to control every aspect of life and give every little thing a label and declare it either good or bad, and if it's good, promote it, and if it's bad, stomp it out of existence. All human existence is politicized and everything is judged according to political ideological criteria and corrected or destroyed accordingly. Gee, if a man's mind cannot be rectified or freed from incorrect thoughts, then he ceases to be a man. He becomes an, quote, enemy of the people. Extermination is justified, demanded in fact by the logic and ideology of class war, as is absolutely clear from the abominations of the Gulag, which, remember, was staffed and run and theorized and set up entirely by Jews. Entirely by Jews. That's the reason you never hear about it in the West. That's the reason Solzhenitsyn's book, 200 Years Together, Jews and Russians, has never been translated into English. They don't want you to know the truth about what they did to the Soviet Union. They are a dirty, dirty, lying, murdering people. Living off us, while lying to us about us. Why do we tolerate it? Extermination is justified, demanded, in fact, by the logic and ideology of class war, as is absolutely clear from the abominations of the Gulag. And the Laogai, the role of, I guess the Laogai would be the Chinese Gulag. The role of ideology, Marxism-Leninism, is crucial, as has been fully explained by Solzhenitsyn. Okay, again, Marxism-Leninism is the source of political correctness. Political correctness is communism. Solzhenitsyn says, Macbeth's self-justifications were feeble, and his conscience devoured him. Yes, even Iago was a little lamb, too. The imagination and the spiritual strength of Shakespeare's evildoers stopped short at a dozen corpses because they had no ideology. Ideology, that is what gives evil doing its long-sought justification and gives the evildoer the necessary steadfastness and determination. That is the social theory which helps to make his acts seem good instead of bad in his own and others' eyes, so that he won't hear reproaches and curses but will receive praise and honors. Because you're killing a class enemy, like a kulak. Or you're defaming a white male. You're following the correct narrative. White males victimizing innocent black females. You're goody-goody John Grisham. You're a lawyer, and you're trying to become a novelist. Get up at dawn and you write a couple chapters, and how are you going to characterize? You remember an interesting race case or rape case you came across? You know, are you going to put it in the actual terms of the rape, or are you going to reverse the races so that the black girl's the victim? And white Klansmen are the rapists. What do you think he did? Well, you know the truth. Okay, and he's still talking about other people talking about political correctness. Another anomaly is that none of the works consulted includes any references to political correctness in the indexes. The squeamishness explicitly to highlight the connection between communism and political correctness is perhaps an indirect acknowledgement that political correctness on the American campus and elsewhere does indeed owe a great deal to Mao and his antecedents. It is perhaps born of the fear that any discussion of the connection will provide ammunition for conservative opponents of multiculturalism. Whatever the reason, the lack of any discussion at a time when arguments over political correctness were taking place in the U.S. and Britain, and when some of the authors were working on books about communist China's cultural revolution, is highly unusual, to say the least. In the Russian context, the same is true of Ruder and Tolstoy. A more recent trend, and one more effective than Kennedy's denials, is to treat political correctness with a certain disdain or even silence, without actually denying its left-wing credentials, and without renouncing the methods and goals of political correctness and multiculturalism. The BBC, Britain's state television and radio network, is especially adept at this sort of Orwellian deceit, appearing to state one thing but encouraging behavior and attitudes which are entirely consistent with politically correct objectives, even if not referred to as such. Many Russians, Poles, Czechs, Bulgarians, and East Germans who revered the BBC as a surrogate domestic broadcasting service during the Cold War will balk at such an apparently harsh comments. Yet when it comes to the ugly side of multiculturalism in Britain today, and much of it is very ugly indeed, the BBC lacks that commitment to objectivity and truth, which once made it so feared by the men in the Kremlin. When Greg Dyke, who is appropriately known as the BBC's Director General, apologizes for the fact that the BBC is, quote, hideously white, one realizes the degree to which politically correct ideas now control and shape the BBC. To paraphrase one of its first director generals, the BBC has become a social menace of the first magnitude. Two paragraphs to go. Despite the determined efforts of liberals and left-wingers to counter the association of political correctness with their favored causes, the perception remains among the public that political correctness is essentially a creation of the left. The historical evidence, some of which I have marshaled here, supports that association, even though even now a few seem to realize just how strong the Soviet legacy is. Enriched by his successors, Soviet, Maoist, feminist, postmodernist, and most recently multiculturalist, political correctness still bears the stamp of Lenin, the founder of 20th century totalitarianism. Let me repeat that. Political correctness still bears the stamp of Lenin, the founder of 20th century totalitarianism. The father of political correctness is Lenin. The empire Lenin helped to build is, thankfully, no more. Yet 100 years after his tract in Revolutionary Subversion, What Is to Be Done, was first published, his ideas still command a great deal of loyalty. Ideas do indeed have consequences, as Richard Weaver has argued. Contemporary versions of political correctness are Lenin's revenge. To conclude, I offer an allegory. It's a pessimistic and belongs to the genre of low-budget horror films. Imagine a giant arachnid. That's a spider, to those of you who are not familiar with the dictionary. Defeated and mortally wounded, which in its death throes manages to ejaculate a stream of spores. The victor, savoring his hard-won triumph, fails to see that the spores have landed on his body. If not decontaminated, they will begin the process of his metamorphosis into the very monster he has just vanquished. I disagree with him there somewhat, and my only complaint with this, and that's his conclusion, is that he has certainly identified the communist roots of political correctness. But the point he has not harped on is that this is a Jewish phenomenon. The Jews are those spores he describes. The spores took over the nice white piece of bread, or a nice black Russian bread, and rotted it out, and those spores are now active on the American loaf as well. The Jews were the originators of these ideas, and they are the prime carriers of them. The Jews are the driving power behind communism, and political correctness is communism. So the Jews, by the transitive property of equality, are the driving power behind political correctness. And that is why I say to you, my friends, and with this I sign off, no Jews, just right. Good night.